On this episode of the Sophisticated Property Investing Podcast.
Why are property trainers such big fans of the new big shiny strategy? And it's exactly the same reason as fashion designers changing the fashion every season. Like, if clothing looked great last summer, why has it got to be different this summer? Well, the only reason to make it different this summer is they want to sell more clothes.
Welcome to Sophisticated Property Investing, a podcast brought to you by Ethical Property Partners, the experts in sophisticated property investment.
So welcome to the podcast. I'm Pauline Chalmers, and in this episode, I'm interviewing Frank about how to simplify my plan. So rather than running from one investment strategy to another, how do I simplify my plan? So Frank, when I first started, welcome Frank. Sorry, I just thought I'd launch there and apologies.
I was going to wait for the monologue to continue. Go ahead, Pauline. It makes a pleasant change from Liz, who doesn't let me get a word in edgeways. So that's great. She'll listen to this and tell me off.
I know. Well, I know Liz's disc profile, so I get it. When I started investing and really looking to invest in my property business, there was lots of different investment strategies that all the trainers were talking about. And there seemed to be each one was better than the previous one. And it can be really difficult to decide on which one to go for, as they all seem great. So can you give us some background as to why you believe that having a simpler flat plan is going to be much more effective?
Yeah, for sure. I'm going to go off on a tangent, as I often do initially there. And that is just to think about, why are property trainers such big fans of the new big shiny strategy? And it's exactly the same reason as fashion designers changing the fashion every season. Like, if clothing looked great last summer, why has it got to be different this summer? Well, the only reason to make it different this summer is they want to sell more clothes. And it's the same. If everyone had last summer's clothes, they wouldn't buy more this summer until you make, oh, but look, this is the new stuff. This is what you really, really want. This is better. And then everyone goes out and buys that. And so it's the same with shiny new property strategies. If you went on a rent-to-rent course 3 years ago with X property trainer, and they're still only offering rent-to-rent courses, you either did rent-to-rent and it worked for you and you've used that knowledge and you've got a rent-to-rent business now, or you did the course and it didn't work for you. It's going to be one or the other. But either way, you're not going to go back on the same course. And so they need to come up with, just like the fashion designers, a new shiny program for you to come and learn. So now it's service accommodation or this or that, HMOs, or it's emergency accommodation, or it's blah, 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 blah. And they're always having to sell new shiny strategies in order to keep their training busy. And I'm not blaming them, just as I don't say, you know, Levi should keep changing their jeans. It's just the way it is. But that's not necessarily in the best interests of the individual investor. The individual investor is often better served by focusing on a strategy and getting really good at it. So for me, there's a few reasons why being too broad doesn't work. And my wife's been a business coach for 10 plus years, and I've worked with many business owners, either in a coaching capacity or in a mastermind capacity. I mean, two masterminds at the moment. And it's interesting. The most successful business owners are ones that focus on a niche, as the Americans call it.
Is that a niche?
That's a niche, precisely. Yeah, sure. For those of you that, this goes out, we've got a big audience in America, I shouldn't mock it, yeah. So a niche or a niche. And so that specificity makes the business better, not worse. So to a novice business person, and I made this mistake when I started my estate agency 13, 14 years ago, you think, well, I'll cater for this really wide array of business people so that or customers, so that I can have loads of customers. So a business coach is a good example. A business coach will say, right, I'm going to coach anyone with a business. It can be a one-man band. It can be a 10 million company. It can be in the service industry. It can be B2B, B2C, doesn't matter. I'm your coach. Well, that straight away makes it really hard to market. And it's the same in property. If you are looking for people who are wanting a really quick sale and need money quickly, and you're marketing for people who are in negative equity, so the first group are happy to sell now and take a discount, they're happy to sell BMV. And then the second group are people who are in negative equity and just want you to start paying their mortgage, so more of a rent-to-rent, lease option kind of solution category. And you're looking at portfolio landlords who've got 10 plus properties. How do you cater to all of those? And a friend of mine is a business coach, but he only coaches tradespeople. And you might think, wow, he's cutting out 95%, 98% of the business population by only focusing on people who are tradespeople. But his marketing is phenomenal. He knows exactly the language to use. He knows how to get in front of those tradespeople. He knows where what groups they're on Facebook. He knows where they're located. He knows how they spend their time, et cetera, et cetera. And so getting clients is a lot easier for him. But then helping those clients to get results is a lot easier as well. So if we go back to those three types of vendors in the property investor situation and forget about the business coach for a moment. Marketing to people who want a quick and certain sale, your messaging is going to be really clear. It's going to be, you know, are you in arrears? Are you emigrating? Have you just inherited a property? Would you like to sell quickly? I can make you a cash offer in 7 days. That kind of marketing, that's really clear. It's going to appeal to the people that want to sell quickly, and they know that it's going to be at a discount. And then when you're speaking to those people, so you're going to get lots of leads from your marketing. So your cost per lead is going to be low, which is great because it's all about the numbers, the acquisition cost of our deals, which you should track. But you're going to get more of those leads for less marketing spend, which means you're going to be better at speaking to them. Because if you get 5 phone calls a day, all from people who need to sell quickly, all from people who are happy to accept a discount or are willing to entertain the thought of accepting a discount, you're going to get better. So not only do you get the leads more cheaply, but your sales process and your approach gets better as well because you're more practiced at it. Compare this, so that's investor A. Investor B is trying to do all these strategies, not just the three we talked about, but loads of other ones as well. So now he's in his marketing, and you sometimes see marketing like this, it makes me laugh. It's like, do you want to sell quickly? We can buy quickly. Are you in negative equity? We can still help you. Are you a portfolio landlord? In which case, we can buy your portfolio. And the problem is, and you can imagine how many of those conflicting messages you could put out there. You know, you could even, if you live in an area where there's loads of flats at the moment, like flats are really hard to sell because of the cladding issue and because people have wanted to move out of city centres, that is a phenomenal marketing strategy. Now, if you're the guy that helps people with their flats problems, you could do specific marketing just to flat owners that want to move out of their flats. And you could say, have you got a problem with your cladding? Would you like me to buy your flat? I can help you to move on. That's so specific compared to the marketing that says, are you this person? If not, are you this person? If not, are you this person? Because that marketing alienates everyone because they go, yeah, I am that, but oh, I'm not that, and I'm not that, and I'm not that. No. And you're going to, so A, investor B.
It doesn't speak to them quite as clearly, does it, as the one single message that grabs them.
Precisely. That's exactly it. And so you, for the same marketing spend, so investor B, for the same marketing spend as investor A, is going to get less leads, which means he's not going to get as good at selling. So I've spoken to an investor this morning, who one of our clients, who has had 33 leads from his marketing. That's about right for his marketing spend. He's only had 2 help visits, and neither of those have signed up. And I said to him, that's wrong. There's something wrong there. And that was why we had the call. He's like, he said, I'm a bit disappointed with my results. And I said, we looked at the marketing spend. 33 was maybe a little bit low. We'd perhaps have hoped for 35 or 40, but it's not that bad. You know, maybe there's something going on in that location that's depressing the response rate. Maybe one of his leaflet companies has thrown some of the leaflets in the bin, and that, so he's had the right response from, you know, three quarters, and one quarter's gone in the bin or something. I said that there may be an issue there, but not definitely. It might just be the response rate right now. But to have 33 leads and only book two help visits, there's a problem with his conversion rate. His salesmanship on the phone is not good enough. I said he would have been expecting between about 7 and maybe 10, maybe a push 12 help visits from 33 leads. And if he'd gone out to 7, maybe 10 help visits, he would have expected 2 or maybe 3 leads. He's quite a 2 or 3 maybe he's quite a new investor, so 2 or 3 completions, 2 or 3 signups. But he's had none. And I said, so the missing step here, or the missing conversion rate, the weak conversion rate, is you on the phone. There's a problem with you on the phone. So we've just said the next 6 telephone fact finds he does, he's going to record them, he's going to send them into HQ, we're going to critique them for him, we're going to solve the problem with whatever he's doing on the phone, we're going to solve that. And that will be easy to do because he's doing the same marketing to the same people day in, day out, compared to the person that's the investor B in that scenario that we're talking about earlier. They're getting not many leads, and every lead they're getting is different. So they get off the phone from a landlord who's got 25 properties. That's a very different conversation to a 40-year-old who has just inherited their parents' property and just wants to flog it. That's such a different conversation. And so you're getting less leads and they're so different, which means you don't get very good at all at actually closing on the phone, actually getting a yes and solving the person's problem, which has a massive impact on the success of your business. And so it's counterintuitive, I get that, to be more specific and to focus on just a few strategies. But the way I this is a funny metaphor. The metaphor I think of is there's a wall of plasticine, right? And behind the wall is some treasure. And your job is to get through, maybe it's a foot of plasticine or 6 inches of plasticine. And your job is to get through the plasticine and get the treasure. And so like investor A is doing the equivalent of running up to the wall, putting his finger into the plasticine, putting all of his body weight behind his finger, pushing through and grabbing the treasure and pulling it out with his hand. Investor B is running up to the wall and just throwing himself at it. He's throwing his whole body and he just goes like smack and doesn't actually penetrate. He doesn't actually get any results. He doesn't get any progress. And that's it's a very graphical one. It's a bit of a crazy example, but
I've never heard that one before. Did you create that one yourself?
I probably did, Pauline. Yeah. And you've been on board like 4 or 5 years, haven't you? So, there you go.
I've never heard that one.
Maybe I need to video.
That's a new one.
There you go.
But it does illustrate your point. Actually, it is like that, really focused, concentrated, and there's still effort in it. You know, it's not that you can just put your hand straight through the plasticine wall and grab the treasure. There is focus and effort in it, but it's that focus that causes the breakthrough, and then you can reach the treasure. Whereas you can see where you've got the more scattergun approach that it has less impact. And I really heard what you said about why people why newbie investors or investors who are experienced but are trying new investment strategies, why they fail, because that level of expertise that you just touched on, where you've got a client who has started marketing, had some results, and they're not quite what he expected, and then what would he do next? Well, through your conversation, you've given him some of the next steps to really hone in and see what's not working and why, because of the breadth of experience that you have and the team has in our marketing and the results that we have. Whereas I can really see why other people don't have that benefit and therefore take a strategy which does work, but they're not expert at it yet because they're starting out, and they never get to become expert at it because of that scattergun approach.
Precisely. That's exactly it. And
yeah,
here's the trouble. We talk about the four key components of an investor that contribute to them having an appropriate business plan. So you have to take these four factors into account when you're writing a business plan. And we've covered it on the podcast before. It's where in the country are they going to invest, their financial situation. So what's their cash flow like? What's their cash in the bank like? Two separate but related financial considerations. You've got the time, how much time they've got available, and also you've got the amount of experience that they've got. So you have to take those four things into account. So let's use this client of mine as an example with the 33 leads. We'll just call him Fred. Fred on EPP books a call with me, a one-to-one call, and says, Frank, I don't think this is working. Why do you think it's not working? And I look at it and I say, well, your marketing's working. 33 leads is appropriate. But the number of help visits, the number of visits to people's homes that you're booking from those 33 calls isn't. And I asked him the question today. I said, why? What are those phone calls like? You know, why do you think you haven't booked 7 or 10 or 12 help visits? And he said, well, a lot of the people just seem to be tire kickers. They just seem to be like trying to find out what their house is worth. Now, that's Fred on EPP. Let's assume we've got Jane, who's not on EPP. What does Jane do? She doesn't know. Is it her marketing that's not working? Like, should she have got 100 leads and then she would have had three times as many help visits and then she would have had some deals? She doesn't know if that's the problem. She doesn't know if it's her on the phone, but she feels like she's having good conversations, just like Fred feels like he's having good conversations. It's the quality of the people. They're not properly motivated. Or is it the wrong strategies? Should she swap strategies and try something else, especially when you're being bombarded by adverts saying, this is the strategy, look how much all these people are making from this strategy. Should she swap area? Is it the area that's wrong? It's really hard to know. And so the danger is you've got the right strategy in the right area at the right time, but you just need to tweak something about it. Fred on the phone, he's good on the phone. He's a good salesman. He's an experienced businessman. He's probably just lacking in a bit of belief. He probably just needs a little bit of coaching, and that will flip the switch and he'll start getting help visits. And so that's the difficulty. The difficulty is how often does something go perfectly the first time you try it? Very rarely.
Really, very rarely. If you're brand newbie, it's not going to go 100% because you're new to it. Is that even in the competency quadrant, it's never going to go perfectly.
Exactly. Like a new person might, we've had this before, they say, I've just spent £2,000 on leaflets and I didn't get a single call. It's rubbish. This doesn't work. And it's like, well, did your leaflet company put the leaflets in the bin? Have you checked your phone number works? Like, people have done that before. They've sent leaflets out and the phone number's not connected. And it's like, I didn't get a single call. So let me call your number. What number have you got in your leaflet? Yeah, it's just going to brrr. Like, yeah, you're not going to get any calls from that. And those are simple things to fix. But it's when it gets a bit more complex, it really helps to have that focus and specificity and to say, no, I've kind of hitched my trailer to this wagon. This is where we're going. I've set my destination. I've got a business plan and I'm going to make this business plan work. And it's that conviction and that focus and that commitment to a single course of action which gets you those results. The number of people that give up just before they reach massive success is huge, absolutely huge. And yeah. Like, you and I both know people on EPP where the first few months it hasn't been great. And then they've started to get a little glimmer of success. And sometimes it can be 6 or 9 or even 12 months in that they really start to get the deals through. And they're like, this is what I expected to be. Other people hit the ground and they fly from day one. But sometimes there's a bit of tweaking and a bit of improvement and a bit of mindset change that needs to go on. But if you keep changing strategies, you never get time to get good. You keep starting afresh and having to learn from scratch. And we're all pretty rubbish the first time we do something. So,
Definitely. Yeah. And also if you've got the whole group to compare yourself to in terms of that comparison of how effective you're being in your marketing strategy. When you look at someone else who's doing something similar, you can really benchmark it easily, as you say, and as opposed to being on your own, not knowing what the results could be or should be, but just believing after a short period of time that it doesn't work. Some things, and it's just that small tweak that may have it work, which is great. So how do you decide on which investment strategy? You talked about the four components, about area, time, financial resources, and skill set. But how do you decide on which investment strategy will work better over another one?
Yeah, so those are the four components that the investor brings to the table. And you might think, well, you can't change geography. No, you absolutely can. You can decide to travel somewhere else and invest somewhere else. You can decide to go live somewhere else. So those four the investor brings to the table. The fifth one that we've not talked about is their goals. So where do they want to be? And we typically would do a 12-month plan initially. And so where do they want to be in 12 months' time? If an investor's got the goal of doing 10 or 12 deals in the next 12 months, then that's going to be a very aggressive plan. Other investors come on board, even to us, when they know what's possible, and they'll say, look, I just want to invest 15 hours a week and I'd like to do 4 properties in my first year. That'd be amazing. And it's really interesting, isn't it? I think, why are you laughing? Just 4 deals, is that what you're
laughing? Just 4 deals in the first year. Yeah,
exactly. And we know that that's really low and really easy to achieve. But I think this is another novice mistake. People sometimes set the bar so high for themselves that they're almost guaranteeing their failure. And so we know that it costs around £3,800 per completed deal. That's the marketing spend per deal. And let's just round it up to 4K for ease. So if you want to do 10 properties in a year, that's £40,000. That's a significant monthly spend. Mm. If a newbie comes on board without support and's like, right, I'm going to hit this, I'm going to spend, you know, £5,000 a month in my first few months to really get my funnel full, that's a massive amount of pressure. You think you can just imagine a spouse in the background going, have we got any deals yet? No. How much we spent £10,000 on marketing? Are you sure about this? And the doubts start to creep in. And you know, we've only got £100,000 and you're spending £5,000 a month at the moment. And don't you need a massive deposit to buy the property? And you can just almost imagine the erosion of that. You know, this is amazing, I'm definitely going to win on day one. And day 10, it's like, oh, what have I done? You know, compared to, and this is why you've already mentioned it today already, the DISC profiling. We look at personality profile, we look at experience level, we look at ambition and goals, and we factor all that in with the financial situation, the time abundance, to make sure that it's a plan that's sustainable, that's not going to put the investor too far outside their comfort zone. They need to be a bit outside their comfort zone because they need to grow and they need to improve and they need to develop a skill set and a business they don't have today in order to hit their goals. But for me, I actually think being slightly more conservative is often a way of building confidence and momentum more quickly. And what I say to my clients is, look, let's just start off with 2 in your first 6 months or 2 in your first 2 months. So it depends on their ambition, because we can always revisit the plan in 6 months' time. In fact, we do a 6-monthly review. So even though we plan for 12 months, I sit down with every client, or one of my team at HQ do, sit down with every single client after 6 months and say, how are you getting on? Are you on track? Let's have a look at all your marketing stats. Let's look at all of your completions, all of the deals, and let's refer back to your plan. And more often than not, it's a pleasant surprise that they're ahead of the curve in terms of their goals, which is great, because then they can either stick with that plan and know that they're going to overachieve, or they can actually change their plan and raise their aspirations and their goals and start investing at a higher level. So it's I think being realistic, it's definitely stretching and ambitious, but realistic is critical to staying the course and still being in the business in 2 and 3 years time and getting successful.
I can really hear that. Are there specific skills that are required for specific strategies, do you think? Is there going to be some individuals who are better at some strategies than another?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I've mentioned personality profiling, but personality profiling doesn't do it all. A lot of it is intuition and experience of judging what people do. So there's a whole breed of people who talk a big game and actually don't take much action. And I'd say that's the biggest skill that people need. If people actually take action, 9 times out of 10, they'll get success because they're going to get feedback, i.e. results, not necessarily good results. And then they can improve themselves. They can course correct. They'll get more feedback. And, you know, people talk about making mistakes and stuff. That's just feedback. It's useful feedback in order to change your approach, change what you're doing, tweak what you're doing. Like that investor that I spoke about earlier with his 33 leads, you know, he's taken action. If he hadn't taken any action, we wouldn't know if he was a genius on the phone or if he was rubbish. It seems he's a little bit weak on the phone, so we can work on that now. He may be weak at help visits in front of people. I doubt it. He's a really personable guy. He's run businesses before. I think he'll be brilliant in front of people. He probably just needs to tweak how he builds rapport and how he communicates the win-win solution to a vendor on the phone. So, yeah, it's definitely important, if not critical, to match the strategy to the investor. We've got investors as young as, I think 26 is our youngest partner on the partnership.
God, I'd love to be 26 again and starting now with what I know. Wouldn't that just be great? Oh gosh,
I remember how green I was at 20. I did start at 26. That's when I started investing, and oh my goodness, it was I cringe at the mistakes I made then. I could have done so many more deals if only I knew what I knew now. But that's the point I'm making, actually, is the 26-year-old, I wouldn't be suggesting they go and buy portfolios off landlords because they're not going to have the credibility. They're going to struggle. I remember how much I struggled. I wouldn't suggest they do TDIC flips to waiting investors, because recruiting investors, you have to have some credibility. And, you know, how many properties is a 26-year-old going to have? How many investors are going to just judge the book by its cover and not give them the time of day? So I would be suggesting that particular investor who's in their 20s would be marketing to individual vendors and would probably not be flipping, probably keeping the properties themselves, maybe using sophisticated financing so that they're not using regular mortgages, because it would depend on their mortgage ability, but
yeah,
you know, so they might be using vendor finance, they might be using purchase lease options, they might be using exchange or delay completion, etc. Until they've built up their experience, and 5 years in, they're going to have a portfolio of 20, 30 properties potentially. They're going to have a lot more experience, they're going to carry themselves differently, they're going to speak more confidently. Now they can start negotiating with investors that have got 10 properties because they're coming from a position of not superiority, but credibility. That's the thing. Some people are just not confident enough to go and find investors, but are happy to be a quite meek and mild person sat in Mrs. Moggin's front room and negotiate buying her house from her at BMV. And so I would structure their business plan around, look, you're going to have to step out of your comfort zone. You're going to have to get comfortable sitting with one vendor in one front room at a time. And I can see people, they go, oh, okay, I can do that. I can build up to that. Yeah, no problem. Okay, can I watch some examples? Yeah, we've got videos of help visits, real ones, acted ones on the vault. Just watch those, learn them word for word. Okay, yeah, I can do that. I can do that. But I wouldn't dream of sending that person or suggesting that person put networking, you know, business networking in their plan, because they're just going to fail at it. And who wants to do something they're rubbish at and doesn't suit their personality? If you told me that you wanted me to buy, this would be a funny one for me to do, right? Buy, one of our partners specializes in this, but buying half done developments and finishing them off. That would just drive me crazy. I struggle having enough like attention to detail to do a development when I've started with a greenfield site, but picking up someone's like bag of nuts and bolts and trying to fix it. Oh my God. He is awesome at it. He buys them at such a good price. He's a tradesman himself. So he's got all the other trades around him. They're good at troubleshooting. He has good rapport with them. He, He trusts them, they trust him, and they fix other people's problems. And he's doing deal after deal like that and making really good money. That would drive me crazy. And that's because I don't have that level of attention to detail. So yes, to answer your question, it's very important actually, because it doesn't matter. If that strategy could make me a couple hundred grand a month, it wouldn't matter. I wouldn't enjoy my business. I wouldn't enjoy doing it, which would mean I'd be rubbish at it, which would mean I wouldn't make a couple hundred grand a month. I would end up doing rubbish. Whereas you show me a strategy that I'm going to enjoy. So I did for 8 years, I was a member of BNI. In fact, we've got Charlie Lawson, National Director of BNI, coming on the podcast in a few weeks. So he runs and owns Business Network International, which is a global franchise. UK, so he UK and Ireland, he owns that master franchise and supports all of the thousands of BNI members across the UK. I was a member of that organization for 8 years, loved going there every few, I think it was a Thursday morning I used to go, and standing up and saying, right, I can help you buy properties, this is what we do, you buy them at full market value, you do this, you do that, I do this for you, guaranteed rent, you know, I do the refurb at my cost, blah, 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 just basically selling TDIC. And I did 100 grand a year every year for 8 years just from that BNI group, you know, just from the referrals from that group. It was phenomenal. I loved that. So I did well at it. So I got better. So I loved it even more. That's the positive spiral of reinforcement that you want from your business plan. But if you've picked a strategy or strategies that don't suit you at a values level. So talk about the identity iceberg, you know, a deep seated level, deep below the surface. Doesn't matter how much you tell yourself you need the money. Doesn't matter how much you tell yourself you need to make this work. You're pushing water uphill. I'll tell you a good example, a book recommendation. It's a book by Joe Girard. And I think I'm going to have to look up the title. It's something like How to Sell Anything to Anybody. He is in the Guinness Book of World Records for being the best salesman in the world. And
Yeah.
He sold more cars and vans to individual people. So not like corporate sales, you know, 100 vans to this company or whatever. Individual sales than anyone else in the world in the year that the Guinness Book of World Records gave it to him. And so he's literally the best salesman in the world. It's quite, what an accolade, eh? So, and you read his book, and he says that he gets asked all the time, why don't you open your own dealership? Because he still works for someone. He's basically got a 9-to-5 job. It's amazing.
Gosh, wow.
And he opened
it. That's doing something that you love though, isn't it? I'm guessing that he must have loved what he does.
And that's what he says. That's what he says. He said, I can make more money being a dealer, but I'd be sat in an office. I love speaking to people. Now, he's got it to a fine art, right? He's got someone doing his direct mail campaigns for him. He's got someone customers come in saying, can I speak to Joe? Like there's 8 salesmen there. They only want to speak to Joe. They've been recommended to speak. They come in holding his business card that someone's given them. So he has like a fluffer that meets them at the door and takes their details and says hi. Then he's got a test driver. So someone else then takes, so he comes out and goes, oh, hi, great. What are you looking for? Brilliant. Let me introduce you to Dave. He's going to take you on a test drive. Here you are, Dave. Speak to you in half an hour, guys. And then he's doing the same with the next. So he's got like a conveyor belt. And then when they get off their test drive, they come into his office, he sits them down and he closes them. And he says, I love it. I do it all day long. Some days I do 5, some days I do 10 sales. It's amazing. Like most sales guys are doing like 2 or 3 a week, and that's a good week for them. And he's doing that in the morning. But my point is, he loves it. And so he said, in fact, in the book, I can recommend the book thoroughly. He says that the only thing he enjoys as much is training others to sell. And so what does he do now? He spends a load of his time traveling all around the world, teaching sales, and a load of time still selling individual cars to individual people because he loves it. People ask me, when are you going to retire, Frank? I work crazy hours. I love it. I don't think I'll ever retire. I hope I'm still doing this in my 80s because I love it so much. Hopefully I won't like still be buying as many houses as I'm buying now. But I would miss sitting down with the odd vendor. I'd miss, you know, refurbing a property, I'd miss the little bit of excitement I get when I flip a property or when we house, you know, a bunch of homeless people in one of our Stepping Stones properties. I would miss that.
It's the completions. I love when we get the keys. It's like, yeah, because, you know, with what we do, we make money when we buy it. That's what we plan to do, make money from day one, which is brilliant. And you've touched on something actually about skill set, where anyone that's you know, changing strategies or wanting to develop their skill in a strategy, if they don't already have the skills to manage that whole strategy, then they can joint venture with someone who does have the skills to complete on that strategy. And one of the two things you mentioned, one was where if you're sourcing properties from vendors and you want to flip that property using the TDIC structure to an investor, but you've been able to work with vendors, but you haven't got the skill to work with investors because you haven't built that muscle, then you can joint venture with someone who has got that skill, so you can marry the two of them up. And you talked about for yourself when you're doing the developments, you recognise that your attention to detail, completely picking up someone else's,
tread carefully. Yeah. is rubbish, is Frank. Yeah.
No, it's really great, but it doesn't suit that type of strategy where you're making it more niche around picking up developments that are half completed, where, you know, it's not necessarily attractive to a lot of people. You partner with someone who's got that skill and who completes on it, which is great.
To be fair, that's such a good point, because I actually have realised that I don't particularly enjoy any kind of development. I recognize that it's massively lucrative. I actually prefer the design and the negotiation with the planners and working out what will fit on a site with the architect and working out maximum values, maximum returns from a given plot. I love that. The actual breaking ground and building, that's like quite a distant second to me. So I've got a development at the moment. In fact, I've been out to site this morning to meet with Highways and do the bit I love, which is basically negotiating why they should give me access to this site, despite the fact that they don't like the access to it. And it's like, well, how about we chop this wall down a bit, and how about we make this a bit wider? And I didn't know this. Every day's a school day. It's like a dirt track. With a bit of grass in the middle and stuff, this access. And they said, well, it would help massively. I'm thinking I've got to buy a bit of land off the neighbour to like cut their wall down and widen it. And they said, to be fair, if you could just tarmac this and then put a little drain at the front apron of the drive where it touches the pavement, that would make it a lot safer. And I'm like, really? That's easy. Like, how much tarmac do you need? Oh, if you could just do 5 meters of tarmac. Like, yeah, we can do that for a development. No problem at all. You know, and that's the thing. I love that bit. But the bit where we actually break ground and you can, you know, burn through cash if you get it wrong, if it takes too long, if you have poor tradesmen, if you do things in the wrong order. So I'm actually, on that particular development, I've partnered with two of our guys, one of whom's, in fact, Mark's been on here. Mark Armstrong's been on as he's an architect in his day job and doing some phenomenal developments down in London with his wife, Kira. We're doing a JV on it. So I've sourced the land, I've purchased the land, I'm getting the planning permission through, and then they're going to project manage and build it, which is a brilliant match. I'll still oversee it, I'll still be involved because, you know, it's still my property, but we've done a deal whereby they're going to do that for me because A, I trust them implicitly, and B, quite frankly, they're better at it than me. I'm not too proud to say that, you know, I'm excellent at all these things. I actually think that you can be more successful if you recognize your weaknesses and recognize your strengths, because then you mitigate against your weaknesses, hence bringing someone else on, and you can play to your strengths, focusing on those things that you're really good at and that you're better at. There's a story, it's a bit out of date now, but Tiger Woods, when he was the best golfer in the world, like undisputed best golfer in the world for quite a long period of time, I think he was the best driver in the world, or definitely top three driver. So he could drive straighter and further than anyone else. But he was only, and that's a relative term, only the 16th best player in the world for hitting the ball out of a bunker. And if you think of our kids in school, a lot of them will focus, a lot of teachers will focus on the kids that are struggling. You know, Johnny's great at maths. You know, when you sit down and you hear your kids' parents evening and they go, yeah, Johnny's great at maths, he's great at English, but oh, he's really struggling at science. So let's talk about what we're going to do to improve his science. And it's like, or let's just help him be amazing at what he's good at and, you know, not focus on the... And it's just, it's a really interesting psychology we have as a as an education system. And obviously, I've been through it as a teacher. And so if you think about that with Tiger Woods, he just focused on hitting the ball straighter and longer. Obviously, you can't be appalling. You can't take 10 shots to hit out of a bunker. But he was 16th in the world. He was okay at hitting out of the bunker. To get to be top in the world at hitting out of the bunker, he would have hit more bunkers because he couldn't practice his driving so much. And so there's definitely a lot to be said for focusing on your strengths. Yeah,
I really got it. It's really clear. So in that sense, what you've really illustrated is why to keep it simple in terms of business plan. Yes, there's lots of investment strategies out there and there's lots of new ones that might come up, but actually taking into account the four considerations around where you want to invest, how much time you have, how much money, and how much skill you have in that area, and then really, really honing that skill to improve and excel on that strategy is far more lucrative than the scattergun approach. And I love the analogy of the plasticine wall, where you put your finger in to get through to the treasure rather than throwing yourself at it. So Frank, thank you very, very much for giving us the benefit of that expertise and really, and also being really frank as well about your expertise and getting yourself that what you love and what you're not so good at is where you'll joint venture with people and either you won't do that strategy or if it comes up, you'll work to joint venture with someone. So really, really thank you for your time.
Thanks, Pauline. Really enjoyed it.
And for everyone listening, thank you for listening in and we look forward to seeing you soon.
Cheers, guys. Bye.
Sophisticated Property Investing, a podcast brought to you by Ethical Property Partners, the experts in sophisticated property investment.